From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Why are U.S. troops in Afghanistan? Hello again, I'm Oren Almy, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Vice President Biden said yesterday that American casualties are sure to rise as more troops are sent to Afghanistan. Even Obama administration advisors say the president's principal challenge is to define the mission. Critics warned of a quagmire the U.S. can't afford. Afghanistan is bigger than Iraq and harder to pacify, and efforts gone wrong could destabilize Pakistan, the nuclear-armed neighbor next door. What are America's goals and objectives? What are the benefits and the risks of possible options? On Reporter's Notebook later on, can the New York Times survive as we know it? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at GatesFoundation.org.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. President Obama promised to get U.S. troops out of Iraq and send more to Afghanistan. Vice President Biden says more casualties should be expected. We'll hear about deteriorating conditions on the ground and the risks of escalation. We'll also ask, what's the objective? On Reporter's Notebook, the New York Times may be the standard setter for journalism in America, but Moody's now calls it a junk bond investment. We'll find out why. First, this news update. President Obama today set the stage for a reversal of Bush administration policies on clean air and energy independence. He ordered the Environmental Protection Agency to speed up the process of reducing greenhouse gases emitted by cars and trucks.
We must ensure that the fuel-efficient cars of tomorrow are built right here in the United States of America. Increasing fuel efficiency in our cars and trucks is one of the most important steps that we can take to break our cycle of dependence on foreign oil. It will also help spark the innovation needed to ensure that our auto industry keeps pace with competitors around the world.
After review, the EPA is expected to grant a waiver to California and 13 other states. Zachary Coyle reports from Washington for the San Francisco Chronicle. Zachary, good to have you on our program.
Good to be with you.
What is it that the EPA, or what is it California wants to do? Let's start there.
Yeah, well, California for years has been pushing to get these rules approved. The legislature first approved them in 2002, and they were signed by then Governor Gray Davis. So it's been a long battle for them. They applied to the EPA during the Bush administration to have these rules put into effect. That was blocked in 2007, and the state has been chafing ever since then. What Obama effectively said today is he ordered his EPA secretary to get a move on, and he suggested strongly that he expects that California's rules will be approved.
Okay, California under the Clean Air Act is allowed to do this, apply for a waiver to have tougher standards than the federal government, but these are waivers on greenhouse gas emissions from cars and trucks. We're not yet at the issue of the fuel efficiency standards.
That's right, although the rules call for effectively a 30% reduction in greenhouse gases from vehicles by 2016, but that actually has the practical effect of increasing fuel efficiency standards. That's why the automakers have fought this so fiercely. And I think that what Obama is signaling is he would like the states to be able to effectively innovate a little bit here, knowing full well that if California and now 13 other states have embraced these standards, that it's likely going to push automakers to have to sell these more efficient vehicles in showrooms across the country.
So on the one hand, he is asking the EPA to allow California and the other states to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. He also ordered the Transportation Department to draw up rules having to do with fuel economy standards.
That's right, and this is part of this 2007 law that was passed by Congress and signed by President Bush, which would require fuel efficiency to jump to 35 miles per gallon by 2020. What Obama effectively said today is, let's get these rules written and into effect quickly. The Bush administration had sort of quietly left town without doing the regulating, the rulemaking on this that they were supposed to do.
Today, General Motors announced it's going to cut 2,000 jobs in plants in Michigan and Ohio, halt production at plants elsewhere around the country because of slow sales. What's the automobile industry saying about these actions?
Well, they are saying, and they've made this argument for a long time, that these standards are a burden on them, and forcing them to jump through new hoops and make more fuel-efficient cars will hurt them, as obviously they struggle to retool and face a very, very tough economy. I think Obama and many folks on the environmental side of the equation believe that one of the reasons U.S. automakers are in such bad shape is they haven't been making fuel-efficient cars that consumers are buying, and especially as gas prices soared, we're really pushing towards. So I think what Obama is telling them is, listen, we are going to help you. There's going to be probably more money in terms of a bailout for automakers in the months to come, but you need to do your part and make more efficient vehicles.
He pointed out, though, that the urge to have more fuel-efficient vehicles has become strong when gasoline prices are high and less when they're not. Now they've dropped. Is he going to have the kind of support he's hoping for?
Yeah, it was a really interesting point. I think a point he made is that lawmakers in particular often only address this issue when gas prices are high and then forget about it. And I think what he's signaling here is that he wants a more sustained approach on efficiency, fuel efficiency. And I think also what this is in some sense is a down payment on broader climate initiatives that he'd like to see passed during his administration. But I think he knows that it could be a very very heavy lift to get climate change legislation passed in the Congress this year. And he took this first step today to kind of send a signal of where he wants the country to go.
So he took these steps today. He doesn't have to take. He doesn't have to have Congress to support him on this. Is he waiting to see if, in fact, a market develops for cars that are more fuel efficient?
I think that's right. And in some sense, he wants to help shape and create that market. And California and some of these other states can be a laboratory for that. Obviously, with automakers where they are today, it is going to be very tough for them to move quickly and meet these standards. One thing to remember, California's rules were supposed to go into effect for the 2009 model year. That is cars that are sitting on the showroom right now. So that is going to have to get pushed back a little bit. The EPA and California are going to have to rework that a little bit and obviously give the automakers just a little time to retool.
Okay. Zachary Coyle, reporter in Washington for the San Francisco Chronicle. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Yeah, good to be with you.
In a moment, why are U.S. troops in Afghanistan? On To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Alney back with To the Point. 8 years after being routed by American forces, the Taliban have regained control of much of Afghanistan. Military leaders say 70,000 U.S. and NATO soldiers cannot secure the population, so President Obama has promised some 25,000 more. Vice President Biden had this exchange yesterday on the CBS News program Face the Nation.
So the bottom line here is we've inherited a real mess. We're about to go in and try to essentially reclaim territory that's been effectively lost. So it's going to require, there are going to be some additional military forces. There are going to be additional efforts to train their police and to train their Afghan army. And all of that means we're going to be engaging the enemy more now.
So should we expect more American casualties?
I hate to say it, but yes, I think there will be. There will be an uptick.
Vice President Biden with Bob Schieffer on CBS. Aman Gopal is a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor in Kabul. And Anand, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit more than we heard just from the vice president about what it is that these new troops are expected to do and how much of a leg up they will provide to reclaim land lost, which he said is one of the goals, and also train police and the army?
Well, currently across much of the southern and eastern parts of Afghanistan, the Afghan government and the international forces only have control of the urban centers. These are small villages that are basically 3 to 5 miles in diameter. Everywhere surrounding that, all of the rural areas, the government doesn't have any control whatsoever. In these areas, the Taliban, other insurgents, the bandits are roaming there. And so currently, with the number of troops that are on the ground now, they're only able to stay in these urban areas. And the idea is to try to get them out into other areas and clear out insurgents and then hold those areas after pushing them out. At the same time, they've been trying to, there's been a program for years to train the Afghan army and the Afghan police, but there's a real sense that neither of those institutions are anywhere near where they need to be at the moment. The Afghan police has been accused of being extremely corrupt, and the Afghan army doesn't have the ability to lead missions. It's usually acting in a supporting role to American missions.
Now, you say that the urban centers are, in fact, small villages. Are there more people in the rural areas than there are in the so-called urban centers?
There are, and this is actually one of the big differences between Iraq and Afghanistan. Iraq is more of an urbanized society. So in Iraq, if you can capture the urban center, you can sway the surrounding countryside. But in Afghanistan, you can't do that. The center of the gravity for the population is in the rural areas. So just capturing these urban centers really doesn't change the dynamic because most people are living in the rural areas.
Now, the Obama administration has been very critical of the current Afghan government, the central government of Hamid Karzai. President Obama said that Karzai needs to get out of his bunker. Secretary of State Clinton said that Afghanistan is becoming a narco state. How does that go down with President Karzai?
Well, not very well. There's been sort of a war of words that's been going on between the Karzai government and the U.S. administration for the last few months. It started when Karzai started criticizing the Americans and NATO for civilian casualties. There's been a lot of bombing raids and house searches in the last 6 months to a year, which have led to civilian casualties. And this is, as you can imagine, this is an emotive issue in Afghanistan. And also, Karzai has been growing weak. His popularity is dipped to an all-time low. And he's seeing these civilian casualties as something that's really hurting his stance in the country. So he's lashed out at the Americans, at the Bush administration, and then at the new administration about this.
So the problem began then during the Bush administration. But as far as the Obama administration is concerned, does it appear that they're kind of moving away from President Karzai and the possibility that the central government might, in fact, be able at some point to take over the rural areas and really control them?
There are some rumors and murmurs that the U.S. is moving away from President Karzai. One example is just what you mentioned, is the harsh words of criticism we've seen from Biden and Obama and Hillary Clinton. And these are things we haven't seen in the past. Karzai has been pretty well protected and supported by the U.S. for many years until the last 6 to 8 months. There's also talk about other politicians within Afghanistan that are gaining support from the Americans.
What about using the same kind of strategy that was used in Iraq? And again, I understand the analogies are very broad and not necessarily applicable, but just supplying arms to tribes that don't like the Taliban, aren't associated with al-Qaeda in any way, in the hopes that they'll sort of do the job and that the NATO and American forces won't have to.
Well, this is something that's being discussed about very seriously. Now, but again, there's a big difference between Iraq and Afghanistan. In Iraq, the tribes that are on, these Sunni tribes, are fighting against who they perceive as outsiders, al-Qaeda, coming from other places. But in Afghanistan, Afghanistan's a tribal society. The tribes in the south, Pashtun tribes, are the same type of people who are making up the Taliban. And it's very hard to go in and try to separate the Taliban from some of these Pashtun tribal areas. And also, Afghanistan's been a country that's had a history of civil war and armed militias and warlords. So a lot of people here are a little worried about throwing guns at some of these tribes. And a lot of people say that really the question is better governance and better policing.
What about the Taliban? If, in fact, they have control of so much of the country, do they also have the support of the Afghanistan people?
Well, this breaks down along ethnic lines. The Taliban is a predominantly Pashtun movement, and in parts of the rural Pashtun communities, there is some support. And a lot of the support is sort of a lesser of two evils. A lot of people in these communities feel disaffected from the government, whom they view as either ineffective or predatory, and then they turn to the Taliban, who are, in the final analysis, they are Pashtuns like themselves and coming from the same villages that these people come from. So there's a degree of support there. But in urban areas like Kabul and in the north, where there's other ethnic groups, there's very little support for the Taliban.
Anand Gopal, again, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor in Kabul. Colonel Martin Schweitzer is the Senate Liaison Division Chief for the U.S. Army. He formerly was commander of the 4th Brigade Combat Team, 82nd Airborne Division, responsible for U.S. military operations in six of the southeastern provinces of Afghanistan, the places where the Taliban appear to be in control. And Colonel Schweitzer, good to have you back on our program.
Thank you very much. But just to clarify, it wasn't the southern portion in Helmand. It was Host, Pektika, Pektia, Logar, Wardak, and Ghazni, where I would suggest that the Taliban did not have control because at that time and still today, I think, the effective governance that is occurring.
Well, thank you very much for the correction. Tell us how it is that there's effective governance in one part of the country but not in the other, and is it possible to impose it where it doesn't exist now?
First of all, I'll just tell you, I am the optimist in where Afghanistan is, recognizing that if you had a bar graph, you'd have a little bit dip recently in terms of security environment. But I'm absolutely convinced that with quality governance and quality folks who understand how to provide for the needs of the people, like Governor Jamal was doing in Host and some of the other governors and some of the other provinces that we're working in, you can then create the effect of getting the people, getting the tribe to turn to their government for a better way of life. But I will agree with the preceding comments on, you know, when you get government that is not effective or government that appears to be corrupt, your average Afghan doesn't care for that much. And so they will go with what is the most stable engagement strategy that they're dealing with. And so I'm personally convinced that when you get good governance in Afghanistan, the communities every time will turn to their government for a better way of life. When you get inconsistent or perceived corrupt governance being provided to the people of Afghanistan, they'll shy away from it.
What about the difficulty of accomplishing military objectives, and will the additional influx of 25 or 30,000 troops be able to do the job?
Yeah, I guess there's a premise here that this is, and you probably weren't saying it, but just to clarify, that this is not a military solution. And it's an Afghan solutions to Afghan problems. Well, we can obviously help in Afghanistan achieving its goal of becoming self-sustaining. And the military, our military, or any coalition military can play a pretty instrumental role, but not the decisive role. So as you increase the U.S. force capability, you know, I'm assuming, and I'm pretty sure this is happening, there's also going to be a similar increase in the economic capabilities and tools, information and diplomatic capabilities and tools that will also go forward. So, for example, I'm assuming that there's going to be a pretty significant expanding DOS contribution on the ground where you can now train the governors and the government and put in those institutional infrastructures at the district and provincial levels that really enable government to be able to provide for the people. That's critical. The military instrument will develop capacity, will develop capability, but it's the shaping operation. The decisive operation is what do you do once you create security? What do you do once you've created some of the capability? And that answer, I'm convinced, lies in economic, information, and diplomatic training tools that enable the governmental structure of Afghanistan to provide for its people.
What is the objective, and what are the stakes for the United States? Why is it so important?
Yeah, I'll keep it within my lane. You know, as a brigade commander, former brigade commander in Afghanistan, you know, we were focusing on getting the tribes and the community leaders from respective districts to start plugging in with the district and provincial government. We found all too often, and I'll just repeat what I just said, when the governments were able to provide for the people and provide for them a better way of life, real alternatives, they wouldn't pick the Taliban. They wouldn't pick Al-Qaeda. I'm convinced that the Taliban itself is a very unpopular approach, as indicated by all of the polling data that comes from all the independent organizations. But the challenge is, if the government, for them to look to the government's got to perform in a manner that's not corrupt and that they believe is providing for them and not manipulating them.
Again, Colonel Martin Schweitzer, now the Senate Liaison Division Chief for the U.S. Army. Let's get a very different point of view from a retired Army colonel, now professor of history and international relations at Boston University and author of The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism. He is Andrew Basevich, and Colonel Basevich, good to have you back on our program as well.
Thank you.
What do you think about the goal of the United States here, and what do you think is at stake?
Well, I think we really need to ask ourselves, what is it that we require? What are our interests in Afghanistan? And we also need to ask ourselves how much we can afford I mean, I listened to Colonel Schweitzer talk, and in a sense, it's a very compelling vision that he describes, but it seems to me it's one that we can no longer afford. I mean, we're going to have a deficit this year of something on the order of $1.2 trillion. We've been working the Afghanistan problem for more than 7 years. Progress has been modest at the very best, and it seems to me that one might want to, rather than simply sending more troops, as President Obama seems to be intent on doing, really ask ourselves whether the policy and the assumptions that we've been adhering to make any sense. My own view would be that, you know, when you really get down to it, we really have very few interests in Afghanistan other than wanting to ensure that Afghanistan doesn't become what it was in 2001, namely a place that harbored terrorists intent on killing us. And we ought to at least explore the possibility that there may be cheaper and more effective ways of accomplishing that limited interest other than this project of nation building, which we are committed to.
Well, what about the Taliban, though? The Taliban government was the one that harbored the terrorists. That's why we went into Afghanistan in the first place, after September 11th. Is it in our interests for them to take over the country again?
You know, I am not and would not want to portray myself as an expert on the Taliban. But one of the things that I've been reading lately that strikes me as, again, at least worth examining and thinking about is that we should be careful not to fling the word Taliban around as recklessly as we fling the term terrorist around. What I understand, this may not be correct, is that in a sense Taliban come in various stripes and sizes, and there may be some of them with whom we can cut a deal, make arrangements, so that even if they exercise some political power and authority in parts of the country, we can provide them with incentives so that they won't allow Al-Qaeda or similar organizations to set up shop. And I'm not suggesting that this is a cut-and-dry, guaranteed solution. All I'm suggesting is that after 7-plus years of nation-building, when we find ourselves in a position where the seemingly the best idea on the block is send more troops, spend more money, that we ought to at least pause and ask ourselves if there's a different way to skin this cat.
Andrew Basifitz, again, a professor at Boston University. Anand Gopal, let me go back to you, our correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Are there efforts being made now to negotiate with those members of the Taliban that might, as Colonel Professor Basifitz suggests, be amenable to some kind of pacific behavior?
There are. There's a couple of programs that are in place. One is to try to peel away those elements of the Taliban and other insurgent groups that are perceived to be fighting for local reasons, which can be anything from not having a job to being alienated from the situation because the government is very weak, or for tribal reasons. And those people are fighting for very different reasons than, say, Mullah Omar, who's holed up in Pakistan right now. And so there's an effort on the part of the Afghan government to try to,
okay,
to meet those people and try to reconcile with them.
All right. We're going to continue this conversation after a very brief break on Reporter's Notebook. We'll talk about financial troubles for America's premier newspaper, The New York Times. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Once again, after a decisive victory over the Taliban 8 years ago, things have changed very much in Afghanistan. The Taliban controlling much of the country now once again. And it's being suggested that even though more troops are going there, that perhaps we can't afford what it would take to defeat the Taliban or the nation-building process that would be really required to establish a government and stability, and that perhaps other strategies ought to be undertaken. Let me go back to Colonel Schweitzer again, who's now Senate Liaison Division Chief for the U.S. Army, formerly served in Afghanistan. What about what Andrew Bacevich, retired colonel, is suggesting here, that we really ought to talk about talking to the Taliban, perhaps compromising on who runs the country?
Well, the premise that the good doctor had, and I mean, by the way, we all know Colonel now Professor Bacevich, he's one of the great thinkers out there that all of us in uniform still read and read pretty voraciously today. Having said that, you know, the premise is, you know, where is Afghanistan going to be, then to put a dollar figure on it? Are we talking to get it to a certain level to make it one of the underdeveloped countries of the 21st century, or what? I mean, to define that will then enable, you know, the dollar figure alignment. What I'm suggesting, what I'm referencing is so Afghanistan can become at some point self-sustaining. And to do that, you have to connect government to the people. And to do that, you got to develop capability and capacity. And it's not going to be a quick fix, and I'd absolutely acknowledge that. And I also support his comments on looking for alternate ways to be able to help Afghanistan become self-sustaining, because, you know, no one nation can really incur that, you know, fiscal and time-driven burden. And I absolutely concur with all that. Having said that, there's an implication that the enemy remains the center of gravity and we're going to send over these extra 30,000 people to go get rid of bad guys. And I would tell you that's not it. The center of gravity are the people of Afghanistan. The enemy is simply an obstacle to that objective, and that objective being linking people to the government and getting the government to provide for the people. Troops alone won't make that happen. Troops alone are the supporting operation. So we need to define what those other tools are that will enable that government-to-people link and the government's ability to competently provide for them.
Colonel, Professor Bacevich, back to you. You've suggested that making Afghanistan self-sustaining may be more than the United States is able to do at this point. You have also written that the price of failure in Afghanistan could be very high because it might lead to the destabilization of Pakistan. Can we leave Afghanistan not self-sustaining and have Pakistan be stable at the same time?
Well, it has been. I have to say, I'd like to hear Colonel Schweitzer just expand a little bit on the development piece of the puzzle. And there, too, I have to say I come at it as a skeptic. Just sort of the general U.S. experience in the underdeveloped world of being able to undertake programs that will trigger development, you know, bring nations into modernity. We don't have a tremendous track record there, and I wonder if he sees in Afghanistan in particular conditions that would be conducive to success along those lines. It's an honest question. He's been there. I haven't, but I am very skeptical. But to your point, it's my general view that in many respects that and it's not just my view. We can't think of Afghanistan in isolation. We really have to think of Afghanistan and Pakistan together as a problem, with, in a sense, I think, Pakistan being the more dangerous or the more difficult piece of that problem. And there, too, my concern with regard to our actions in Afghanistan is it's not clear to me that what we do and are doing in Afghanistan is taking us any closer to success with regard to Pakistan. Indeed, my sense is that this preoccupation with the Taliban and trying to attrit the strength of the Taliban, which now is bleeding over into a third front, meaning the predator strikes in Pakistan, could well have the effect, unintended, but the effect of creating greater instability in Pakistan and therefore, in a sense, exacerbating the larger problem we're dealing with.
And Pakistan, of course, being a nuclear power, that is a very scary proposition, if I can put it in those terms. I'll get back to Colonel Schweitzer and let him answer your questions. First, however, we have one more guest to get into our conversation. That's Paul Burton, who's Director of Policy Analysis at the International Council on Security and Development, referred to as ICOS, International Policy Think Tank based in Europe. And Paul Burton, welcome to you.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You have recently reported on the strength of the Taliban in Afghanistan. Tell us, if you will, in the context of the conversation we've already had, what we need to know about it.
Sure. I mean, headline news from ICOS field researchers in Afghanistan is that the Taliban's geographic spread around the country is on the march. We undertook extensive surveying and interpretation of open source attack data in 2007-2008 and found that in November 07, the Taliban and associated insurgents had a permanent presence in 54% of the country. Now, we define permanent presence not as geographic control of that territory, but a capacity to disrupt the security situation. That we define as one significant attack a week. That figure rose to 72% when we released our last report in December of last year. Now, that's a very disturbing figure for every international community member with a vested interest in regaining security in the country.
54% is the current figure?
54% last year, 72% at the start of this year, yes.
Thank you. I want to make sure people understood that there had been that extraordinary increase. Let me go back to Colonel Schweitzer on that. What would it take, Colonel, to reduce it back to 54%? Wouldn't you have to do that before you were able to begin the kind of nation building that you were talking about?
Yeah, I think, again, though, you know, if you want this to be a U.S. or coalition solution, you can put yourself on a Western time watch and absolutely do that and make the enemy the center of gravity and reduce them and remove them. And I would argue that in itself you gain very little, if not nothing, because over time they'll repopulate and they'll use that as an information strategy. They, the enemy, will use that as an information strategy against the population that further says, look how weak your government is. They can't even, you know, they can't keep us out. I think the right answer is the continued development of the Afghan National Security Forces, keeping the Afghan National Security Forces in the lead. Look, here's a fact. Since April of 07, the Afghan army has not lost a contact. Not lost a contact on any tactical level of measurement. Now, as we grow that capacity and they're able to be in more places, that's the bridge until we can get the police to that same level. And they're clearly not there. So my response would be continued development and focus on the Afghan National Security Forces, continue putting them out front and in the lead where coalition's in support so they can establish that trust and capability on the ground. Now, it's going to take longer than most people are comfortable with, and that's what I think Dr. B is exactly right on. And so, well, how do we then accelerate that developing of their security force capability hand-in-hand with the government capability? And I hope that's what the independent of Directorate of Local Governance, working as a separate, almost a cabinet-level organization, focusing on the governance side as the military forces are focusing on the Afghan development side, security force development.
Paul Burton, back to ICOS once again. What do you think is a reasonable expectation, particularly in terms of time?
Well, I think Colonel Schreitz is absolutely right. Development of a viable indigenous security force is absolutely pivotal, and a lot of U.S. capital has gone into that strategy. If you don't develop a national standing army that can project power on behalf of the government around the country, then the situation will never improve and achieve even a modicum of stability. However, we're one of the few organizations with local Afghan research staff on in Kabul and in parts of the south in Kandahar and Lashkar, and we hear a very familiar story from a lot of that research, and it's that the government in Kabul doesn't extend to us, the international community's presence does very little in terms of giving us hope for the future and a viable, sustainable income. We've done a lot of work on counter-narcotics policy and seen that where eradication, which has been the Bush administration's favorite option, has occurred kind of piecemeal in certain parts of the South, you're pushing in citizens and farmers who want to be on the side of right in Afghanistan into the arms of the insurgency just to gain an income where their crops have been eradicated. So I think that's a key issue for the Obama administration to tackle now. And ICOS recommends, just very quickly, on that, a scheme called Poppy for Medicine, which looks at converting Afghanistan's opium into morphine for sale onto the global market where there's a shortage of this pain relief drug. And this is a scheme that's already happening in India and in Turkey, so it's a viable option for Afghanistan. And we call on the Obama administration now to introduce a pilot project to test the efficacy of this. But yes, we have to be in Afghanistan for the long term, because let's remember, no one invited into Afghanistan. We went there with a particular mandate to remove al-Qaeda, Taliban. That mandate, 7 years on, still stands, but there's a lot of other factors now that possibly wouldn't have occurred had we not gone in. So we owe the Afghan people our resolve and our sustainable presence in the country.
You said mandate to remove the Taliban. Now, what about the effort to negotiate with those members of the Taliban who are amenable to that and who might want to have a peaceful accord with some form of central government, whether it's the Karzai regime or something else?
Yes, well, I mean, we know throughout history, from malaria insurgency to Northern Ireland to Iraq to a certain extent, you don't solve insurgencies from the air. And I think the predisposition of NATO forces to use aerial strikes upon civilian populations is simply radicalizing vast swathes of the country. So yes, I think where there are moderate aspects of the Taliban that we can identify, isolate, and then bring to the table, it's a strategy that just simply has to happen. Otherwise, you simply create more layers of this insurgency that we lazily deem Taliban, but actually, as Professor Besovich has outlined, is multi-layered and multifaceted. And there are elements within that are quite sophisticated and adept political operators that aren't bent on violence, who we could potentially bring into our camp.
Paul Burton, again, with the International Council on Security and Development, ICOS. Let me go back to Colonel Besovich, Professor Besovich at Boston College. What if the as I understand it, what you're saying is that developing the standing army, doing the nation building, getting the making all the kinds of changes that we've heard about, may be more than the United States can afford to do at this point. Suppose we focus only on what you believe ought to be the goal, as I understood you to say it earlier, and as I've read in your writings, and that is to remove what is really a threat to the United States, people who are out to destroy the United States and to kill Americans. What would it take just to do that?
Well, I think that the approach that I'm suggesting we examine is one that begins with acknowledging the decentralized tradition of Afghan politics, and recognizing that tradition therefore leads you to say that the notion of creating a centralized form of government where effective governance is exercised from Kabul across the entire landmass of Afghanistan, something that's never existed, would be extraordinarily difficult to achieve. So give that up, work with the decentralized approach, and to try to see if you could provide incentives to these tribal leaders to get them to govern the areas that they control in ways that are consistent with our minimal national security interests. Whether that's giving them guns, whether that's giving them money, whether it's a mix of carrots and sticks, I don't think it's possible for anybody to say in a general way. The problem is certainly a complex one. My position simply comes down to an insistence, really, that the discussion of this protracted presence of more troops, of an investment necessary to develop a nation that has never really been developed, is something that in our present circumstances simply has become unaffordable. If we had an endless reservoir of resources to draw on, maybe some of that would make sense. But the truth is, we're tapped out. The country's in deep economic crisis. it's going to get worse. And those domestic considerations here, our domestic considerations, have to be taken into account.
Paul Burton with ICOS, your response to that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the very concept of throwing guns at the situation is a chilling one, and I hearten to hear that the majority of serious commentators and analysts of the country recognise that fact. I don't think you can underestimate the capacity of ordinary population centres.
We seem to have lost Paul Burton. Obviously, as you can hear, the dial tone has come up, and we don't know the reason for that. Back to Colonel Basevich again. Colonel Schweitzer, your Senate liaison, division chief of the U.S. Army. What about the politics of all of this, and to what extent is the United States Congress likely to commit to a massive military and nation-building effort if, for example, it could do less, as Andrew Basevich suggests, is really the only practical alternative?
Yeah, I don't have any insights on that. I mean, I know what everyone else reads and sees, that there appears to be pretty large support to increase resourcing to support the challenges that are ongoing in Afghanistan. I don't have any inside information on that, but I think that common theme all of us participating in this program today are aware of. So I think that's it. Now, I'd have to take issue with Dr. Basevich on what he just represented. I don't believe that we can look at this challenge in that myopic of a lane. Now, I know why he's doing it, and he's very pragmatic because he's looking at the dollar cost and the will to continue to do it. I'm just convinced that won't assist in any mid or long term of addressing the problem. And I really think that this has got to be built around how we are developing and expanding the governmental institutions at every level that didn't exist prior to 2003, but yet today they're starting to get seeds into the ground.
Let me ask, Paul Burton is now back with us with ICOS, the International Council on Security and Development. And let me ask you a question that would call for a long answer, but we don't have time for it. What about the NATO countries other than the United States and their will to continue this operation? Is it there? Is President Obama going to find any kind of support coming from Europe and the other NATO countries?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a pivotal question, not only for Afghanistan, but for the NATO alliance and its future course. If NATO has an aspiration to be a force that acts out of area, as it is in Afghanistan, then all major member states have to step up to the plate, have to put a proportionate amount of military and economic resources behind their deployments to these countries. And that simply is not happening at the moment. And I think the Obama administration has to apply whatever pressure it can to a number of significant European member state, NATO member states, to step up in Afghanistan. It isn't good enough to deploy with 55 different national caveats, which dictate that you can't enter a combat situation without prior approval from your parliament. When you get that approval, the combat situation is no longer live. There are several somewhat absurd caveats being applied upon European countries, and ICOS calls for these to be lifted immediately to enable NATO to fight the battle that it now faces, which it can't do at the moment on an even basis.
All right. I think we've well-defined some of the extraordinary challenges that lie ahead in Afghanistan. Much more complicated, it would appear, from what took place in Iraq, and we'll see what happens. Paul Burton with ICOS, the International Council on Security and Development, Andrew Basevich, retired Army colonel now at Boston University, his book, The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism, Colonel Martin Schweitzer, formerly in Afghanistan, now Senate Liaison Division Chief for the U.S. Army, and our first guest, Anand Gopal, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor in Kabul. Last week, the Mexican telephone mogul Carlos Slim loaned $250 million to the New York Times. But on Friday, Moody's Investment Services called the newspaper a junk-level investment anyway. We'll hear what's in store for one of the world's great journalistic enterprises in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To The Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/To The Point.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To The Point. In May, $400 million of debt will come due for the owners of the New York Times. With advertising revenue practically disappearing, the timing couldn't be worse. Carlos Slim's $250 million loan will help, but not enough for Moody's to recommend investment. Ken Auletta writes for The New Yorker magazine. He's working on his 11th book on the future of media. And Ken Auletta, it's good to have you on our program.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Is this paper going to go out of business?
I wouldn't think the New York Times is going to go out of business, but it's endangered, obviously. It's almost a perfect storm has hit the newspaper business. Actually, it happened before the recession, but the recession just worsens it. The New York Times, like other newspapers in this country, is seeing that its advertising revenues are going down. Its classified revenues, which used to comprise about a third of its revenues, have been, you know, really eviscerated by things like Craigslist and eBay. At the same time, its circulation is dropping. At the same time, its stock is dropping. So it has debts that are coming due, and its revenue stream is reduced. So it has to figure out ways to borrow money to pay back those debts. And that's the predicament the New York Times is in today. It has to figure out a way to raise money to pay debts coming due starting this spring, but continuing beyond that, at a time when their revenues are shrinking and their stock price is shrinking.
To do this, or to partially help out at least, they've made this agreement with Carlos Slim, but he is getting interest of something like 14%, is he not?
Well, he's getting a choice deal, but so did Warren Buffett when he invested in General Electric and Goldman Sachs earlier this summer. That happens. Oftentimes rich people will come in, but they demand in return for their money that there are certain strings, and in this case, it's an expensive string. On the other hand, the Times has not ceded to Mr. Slim something that he may have wanted but won't get, which is control of the newspaper, and that's important because I think the New York Times is not just a private newspaper; it is the world's most important and most credible newspaper. And it's something that much of the press and much of the public depends on for their information. When you see a front-page story in the New York Times, you could be sure that that story will ripple out to other newspapers and radio stations and television stations and become, in effect, their assignment editor. So it's a very important public institution, which we'd like to see preserved as an independent institution.
You would like to see it preserved. There certainly are people who detest the New York Times.
Absolutely.
And what do you say to them? You know, why for them who disagree with its editorial policies, think it editorializes on the front page and every place else, presumably there are some people who would be happy to see it go.
Oh, no question about that. There are people who are absolutely convinced that the New York Times is a liberal rag, that it has a liberal bias. I don't believe that's true. Now, does the Times make mistakes? Yes. Have they sometimes, with some stories, exhibit a liberal bias? Yes. Is a newspaper editorial page liberal? Yes. But I don't believe that the New York Times editorial policy, in almost all cases, I don't believe that that policy seeps into the front page. I think the New York Times remains the world's best and most credible newspaper. That's not to say it's immune from criticism, or in particularly business criticism. They have not handled their business very well. But it's a great institution. I mean, they spend about $5 million a year covering Iraq today. They have 60 stringers and, I believe, five or six reporters. No, the blogosphere can't substitute for that. No other newspaper puts those kind of resources into covering news or the kind of investigative reporting they do. That's something you can't do on the cheap. You can't cover state capitals and city halls on the cheap. And we need newspapers to do that, good newspapers to do that. The truth of the matter is that many newspapers are going to go out of business. We've already seen the Tribune Company, which owns the Los Angeles Times as well as other newspapers, Chicago Tribune included, declare bankruptcy. Other newspapers are on the market and at a very cheap price and can't be sold because there are no buyers. So the newspaper business is deeply troubled. But some newspapers, and I would argue the New York Times is one, the Wall Street Journal is two, the Washington Post is three, are national institutions that we'd like to see stay alive in a democracy.
Let me ask you a question again. This always happens on this program, but it calls for a long answer, and we don't have a lot of time left. But you called it a public institution. Presuming you could overcome the political objections, what about government subsidy for the New York Times of some kind?
I don't believe in public subsidies for newspapers. I believe in the First Amendment, and I think that if you had a public subsidy for the newspaper, you would have real questions about how independent that newspaper was. I'd like to keep the two separate. That's a church-state issue to me.
You said that the blogosphere can't substitute. There are blogs that are attracting advertisers. Why can't the New York Times and other papers do the same thing?
Well, they try to. The New York Times is a very good online edition. The basic economic problem is that you get people who spend time with a newspaper, with the New York Times, spend an average of about 35 minutes a day. People who read the New York Times online spend an average of 35 minutes a month.
Wow.
And that means that the ad dollars you can get from an online edition is about 10% of the ad for the same ad as you would get in the newspaper. So the economics at this point are not there yet. Now, ideally, if you can have an online newspaper, it's a lot cheaper to produce and distribute, and there's no paper cost. The problem is that the economics, the revenue, you don't have any you don't have the circulation revenue, and the advertising revenue is about a tenth of what it is.
Okay, we can see what the problem is, and we will hope for a solution. I agree with you about the New York Times. Ken Auletta, again with the New Yorker magazine, working on yet another book, his 11th, on the future of the media. Today's program produced by Christian Bordahl with Carmen Radziner and Andrea Brody. I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live in podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.